This is Florida Matters. I'm Steve Newborn. The toll the coronavirus is taking on all of us can be measured in different ways. Jobs that are lost, the money troubles that come with it, the isolation. WUSF Public Media wanted to go beyond the headlines and hear from you, or at least those of you who filled out a survey form we sent out a while back to see how you're doing in these unique times. So today on Florida Matters, we're going to hear from several of those people. And WUSF's Kathy Carter is here to tell us about them. Hi, Kathy.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be here.
Kathy, you produced several pieces on people intimately affected by the quarantine. You interviewed a musician who was unable to perform in front of people, and another woman suffering from a debilitating illness whose treatment is being affected not only by a lack of medicine, but one that's affected by the political discussion going on out there. So first off, tell us, why are we doing this?
Well, I think the important thing for us to do is to tell stories about people. A lot of the news when we were first starting to report on coronavirus was numbers. This is how many people have died. This is how many people have tested positive. We wanted to bring the humanity back to, you know, some of these stories. These are real people that are affected not only by the coronavirus, but the aftershocks, right? The loss of employment, the staying at home.
Any surprises that you found out there talking to these people that you didn't really expect to hear?
You know what I was surprised by? At first, we were focusing on job loss, and it really morphed into something else, how our lives have dramatically changed in so many different ways. And I think with the folks that I talk to that have lost their jobs or that were forced to stay at home was the optimism. We'll get through this. People are worse off than I am. So I really found a lot of that, much more optimism than I was expecting, given the circumstances that we were initially saying, you lost your job, tell us about it, you know?
Yeah, this kind of surprised me because people like you and me were able to work out of home. Like a lot of people out there, we can telecommute, get on the laptop. But a lot of the people you talk to don't have that option. They have to be somewhere. They have to perform in front of people. They have to serve people. They have to be around people. So that was kind of unexpected, it sounds like.
Right. So one of the folks that I spoke with was a musician. Of course, with the restaurants and bars closed and venues closed, her job immediately ceased.
All right, Kathy, let's hear her story.
Today, we meet Sarasota-based singer-songwriter Sarah Nelms. In her own words, Nelm shares what it means to be a performer at this time of social distancing.
I really love performing. It just adds so much to all of life experiences, whether it's in the background at your girls' night or at a wedding or, you know, just to get through a heartache. Like other artistic careers, it's always a delicate balance to actually make a living from your art. But my husband and I were actually doing it, raising a family as working musicians. But now we're pretty much having to reinvent the wheel since all of the venues have closed. I would say we started to get nervous about losing our jobs and all of them drying up about the first week in March. My last gig was March 14th. It was a gorgeous sunset polo match, and I knew that I better really soak that in because it was going to be my last live performance for a while. And we had no idea when we would be making more money. Pretty much immediately, my husband and I both started doing live streaming shows on Facebook. At first, it was like a new project. It felt really exciting to be able to reach people that weren't local, that usually couldn't come to our shows. Those first few shows had a ton of people watching. We were actually able to make pretty good money with tips using PayPal and Venmo. I think at this point, though, pretty much every musician, local and national, is doing live stream video shows. So the audience is thinning out with so much content out there. Other than that, I've adapted to remote music by starting to teach private lessons on video chat. I'm teaching basic music to beginners. I'm teaching voice lessons, ukulele, and beginner guitar. It's been a big change, but I'm really happy to have added teaching to my skill set. I've also done a few live stream concerts that were just kids' music to appeal to a different audience. Other than that, a local neighborhood hired us to do a private concert for their community association online. One of our venues reached out and gave free meals on the day that we were supposed to be performing there. And we're just always brainstorming to think of new ideas to make this work. Right now, we have no idea when music will start to be a priority as businesses start to reopen. If restaurants are at 25% or half capacity, we don't know if they'll be able to afford entertainment if they're barely making their bills, especially after being completely closed down for a while. So that's really scary. Our online stuff is nowhere near enough to pay the bills yet, so hopefully we'll be able to pull through until a bit of normalcy returns. I worry for the whole music community, for all our friends who are musicians and other artists like photographers, but we are resilient. You don't make it this far to be a professional musician without having faced setbacks in the past, so you have to be a fighter to be willing to put yourself out there. We're still learning, and I'm really proud of us, though, as musicians and for all of society for being so adaptable. So I'm hopeful and so thankful to everyone who's been supportive during all of this.
That's a beautiful story, Kathy, finding beauty in the midst of all this coronavirus sadness. Now, you've talked to Sarah since this aired, right? Tell me how her situation has changed, if any.
Just a little bit. She has started to do some live gigs. She's had two already. She has another one May 30th at the Central Cafe in Bradenton performing outdoors. But a lot of her venues are still closed. So even if they were 100%, I spoke with her recently. She said she wouldn't jump right back into a full-time performing schedule because she does have a young child at home. She wants to balance getting back to work with just making sure her family is safe and not exposed too much to anything. She's still doing Facebook Live performances every Monday and Thursday, and she's still doing her remote music classes for kids and adults, which is something she didn't do before the coronavirus. So she was able to add that, you know, new skill set to her career.
So let's move on to your other story about another woman from Pinellas County who's been intimately affected by all this. Part of it revolves around hydroxychloroquine, which has been in the news a lot lately because of what President Trump has been saying about it, right?
Yeah, that's right, Steve. A couple of months ago, President Trump first brought up the drug hydroxychloroquine as a potential remedy for the coronavirus. And this is a drug that has been used to treat malaria and is also used by patients who have lupus. A woman from Pinellas County reached out to us. She does have lupus. Her name is Debbie Butler. And she said she really needs this drug to help her with some of her symptoms. And she was having a hard time finding the drug since it was in the news so much because people were starting to stockpile it. Even states were starting to stockpile the drug. So when we spoke with Debbie Butler, she shared her story of having lupus, why the drug is important to her, and how she was having a hard time filling her prescription.
All right, Kathy, let's hear her story.
Thirty years ago, I was forced into retirement due to systemic lupus. I returned to work, though, because disability income doesn't cover the bills anymore. When COVID-19 turned into a pandemic, I had one contract to fulfill, but all other gigs were canceled. At that time, it was still unclear whether gig workers were to be included in the stimulus package. But what scared me most was catching the virus. Lupus had left me with half a lung on one side, and hearing that this virus attacked the lungs, it was difficult for me to get past the fear of what catching it might mean to me personally. Then, during one of the president's press briefings, the word hydroxychloroquine came out of his mouth. No one knows that word, and even fewer can pronounce it correctly, except for one exclusive part of the population. That's those of us with an autoimmune disease, like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and a few other sister diseases. Hydroxychloroquine is one of the only medications that can actually treat lupus, which is amazing because there is no cure. Right now, I only have 4 pills left. That's 2 days of treatment for me. My pharmacy and I are currently playing Wheel of Fortune to see how long it takes to hit the jackpot and find more hydroxychloroquine for me. It may get here tomorrow, next week, maybe a month, who knows? So what really happens if I go without it? I share this not to gain sympathy, but so that the facts are understood. Hydroxychloroquine is used in autoimmune diseases because it may actually lessen the course of the disease or even arrest it. For rheumatoid arthritis, it helps keep down the swelling and disfigurement that can happen. For lupus patients, it helps in the same way because arthritis frequently accompanies it as well. But mostly, if you're lucky, it relieves a tremendous amount of pain that goes along with both diseases. I'm assuming that that's why it's being sought after by those with COVID-19. We in the RA and lupus communities live with that pain daily, so we understand why it might be desired. But until it's proven that the use outweighs the dangers, not only are you putting yourself at risk, you are putting countless others at risk of becoming sicker than they are now. My hope is that by understanding how important this medication is to so many others, people will stop hoarding it and wait for official approval for use in COVID-19.
Wow, that's a powerful story. Kathy, what's happened to Debbie since then? Has her situation improved at all?
Well, the good news is about a week after her story aired, she was able to get her prescription filled through her pharmacist. Before that, she was cutting her dose in half because she wasn't quite sure how long it would be for her to get her prescription filled. So she wanted to make sure she at least had some in her system to help her. She did work part-time as a brand ambassador, basically handing out products and food to people at different locations. She said she doesn't think that job is going to come back anytime soon, so she heard from a friend that the U.S. Census was hiring, so she filled out an application and she actually did get hired. She will be going door-to-door, being a census taker, and she does believe that there is actually room for advancement. And otherwise, Debbie says she's doing very well. She's got this new job opportunity. She has the drug that she needs to keep her well, and she has started to go back with her small circle of friends that hang out outside on the beach, all social distancing, and she's able to have that social interaction too.
Kathy Carter is a reporter with WUSF Public Media based in Sarasota. Thanks so much for talking to us, Kathy.
Sure. Thanks for having me. And I'll say a quick thank you again to Sarah Nelms and Debbie Butler.
We'll be right back after our break when we'll be talking to WUSF's Jessica Mazaros about a couple of the real stories she helped get on the air. Now we'll hear from WUSF Morning Edition host and reporter Jessica Mazaros about a couple of the real people affected by the coronavirus. Hi, Jessica.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing fine. So you did a couple of these audio postcards that really tug at our heartstrings. This must have touched you in several ways, I'd imagine.
It really did, in different aspects. Speaking to one young woman who's a teenager who couldn't talk to her father who was on a ventilator. And, you know, at the same time, she's going to school online, which is all new. She has the coronavirus. Her mother has the coronavirus and has asthma in the home. And so to hear her story of strength and how she's taken it upon herself to just take care of everybody, that's an amazing story. I felt very honored to speak with her and to give her a voice on our air.
It sounds like these are really good illustrations of some of the things that people are going through that you kind of hear about, but you basically hear numbers, you know, how many people contracted this, how many people died. This really puts a human face on it, don't you think?
It really does. As a morning host, I find a lot of those numbers, and they are important for context. It's important to give our listeners updates, but also with public radio, we're in a unique position where we can highlight these voices and shine the light on members of our community. As public radio, I feel like it's our duty, and it's such a cool thing that we can actually do that. And we didn't even know what this would look like, you know? I mean, we've done this kind of emergency coverage with hurricanes before, but to do this with coronavirus was a completely new experience because it's an ongoing, ever-evolving thing. You know, a hurricane lasts 3 days, and then there's after effect. But this is like we're still in it, and we don't know what's going to happen. And so I think it's important for our community to feel like public radio is the place where, number one, they can get those numbers and those updates and those statistics, but they can also hear those human voices that you were talking about, putting that face to our community.
All right, Jessica, let's start with the first one. This is a 16-year-old girl who was in some serious pain from this. Just give us a little setup here, and then we'll ask you afterwards how they're doing.
Sure. So we're going to hear from Nicole Amador. She's a 16-year-old whose father, Carlos Amador of Sunny Isles Beach, was in Aventura Hospital. He was on a ventilator when I spoke with her. He's a very healthy man, and he was trying to do everything for the family and be the one who would go out in public because his wife has asthma, so she was high risk. And so he was going out a lot to do the grocery shopping and the errands, and he got coronavirus, and he was rushed to the hospital. So we're going to hear Nicole at a time when she could no longer speak with her father because he was on a ventilator and unable to speak.
Let's go ahead and hear that piece right now.
So this is a really hard situation for me and my mom because we're here stuck at home. My dad is also in the hospital in a critical condition. We can't go out. It's just really hard. Your body will hurt. Especially today, my stomach is just horrible. I'm getting vomiting. My stomach hurts so bad. In my life, my stomach has never hurt this bad. My mom also, her body hurts really, really bad. Her oxygen is good because she has asthma, so thank God it's good. My dad never actually let us know that he was in that condition because he didn't want to scare us. He was always the one that used to go out and work and do the groceries for us to stay here because my mom has asthma. So he know that if my mom gets it, that could be really dangerous for her. He was the one that always used to go out. We used to stay at home here, trying to protect herself from the virus. When I saw my dad, his face color started changing. He was trying to breathe so hard. His lungs were so infected with this virus that he couldn't breathe. And I got so scared and I was like, I have to call 911. The rescue came. They took him. You know, he has to be alone. Even though I have it too, they don't even let you see him. At the first day, he called me FaceTime because even though he had the oxygen, he could still talk. Not really, but like, I would ask him questions. How are you? And he would tell me with his hands. Then the fourth day, he calls me. I have to be in a ventilator. I was like, wow, my dad is really in a critical condition. Since my dad was on a ventilator, they put him asleep. So I can't talk to him. So what I do is I call the doctors and the nurses, and they're really nice, and they always tell me about him. My life changed literally in 1 second. In the first days, I thought it was a nightmare, and I wouldn't even believe it. I don't even sleep. All I do is I wake up, I call the doctors, I log into my portal, I do some homework, I can't think, I call again, you know, I'm just, sometimes I feel like I drive them crazy by calling, but it's just, I need to know that he's breathing and he's doing fine at least, you know, he's stable, that's what they always tell me. It breaks my heart seeing my dad like that and the fact that I can't even talk to him or even see him. We cry a lot. Because they have been together for like 20 years, my dad and her, and they really loved each other. And we have never thought that my dad would be in that position because he's a really, really healthy man. I miss you. You have to be strong. And my mom and I are safe. We're healthy and we're waiting for you here.
My life changed in nearly 1 second. Wow, that is some strong stuff from a teenage girl like that, bearing that burden. Jessica, how has her life changed since this aired about a month ago?
Well, there's actually some really good news. This story ends on a lighter note. So Nicole and her mother, Marta Hernandez, both no longer have coronavirus, and her father has come home. So he spent about 40 days in the hospital, and he was on a ventilator for a lot of it. And now they are a happy family and back at home. And this is just, you know, one of those things where I speak with a source I can't forget about it. I texted her every once in a while, how are you doing? How's your dad doing? With always that little bit of fear, you know, because I'm a reporter, but I'm also a person. And when I got that text that said, we're all good, my dad's home, I was like, wow, there is some good news out there, you guys. It was just such a relief for me and for them. I just feel so happy for them, but also just to know that, I don't know, that we get to witness stories of recovery as well. It's not all doom and gloom here.
Well, that stuff really tugs at your heartstrings. You know, as journalists, we're taught, we're trained to be distant, to be that so-called fly on the wall, listening in and not to let our emotions show. But this stuff really sets your empathy really high. And it's kind of difficult sometimes to maintain your distance from your source here, to use a journalistic word, right?
Mm-hmm. Because the truth of the matter is, why should they talk with us, you know, about these personal matters? And I think that if we don't, as journalists, think about people and their emotions and get real with them on a real level, it's an honor to tell their stories. And so I want to make sure that I am being careful emotionally. I am being present. I am being kind and respectful. And this hits close to home for me as well. An uncle of mine passed away from complications of coronavirus. And what I got to see from my side of the family was my cousins, so his sons, not being able to go into the hospital, not being able to speak with him, and then him passing away in ICU on a ventilator, and then the after effect of not being able to have that funeral. And so I think that having seen that separation that the coronavirus creates in terms of people being home and isolated, not being able to go anywhere, and then people being in the hospital, and the only form of communication that you get is from the medical workers who are working to the bone, you know, so they're tired. So I just think that I had a personal understanding of what people who are suffering from the virus, or if they know someone who's suffering from the virus, I kind of had a close to home experience where I understand that there is a separation. And in terms of like how to talk with people about this, I think that sometimes there's just room to be a person, you know.
Right. I'm sorry to hear about your uncle, but best of luck to his family. And I hope everybody gets that chance to say goodbye in their own special way. All right, Jessica, next up, we're going to hear from a restaurateur in Manatee and Sarasota counties, Ed Chiles. Now, if that name sounds familiar, well, he's the son of former Governor Joaquin Lawton Chiles, right?
Yes, he is.
This is about a month ago, right? So it's changed since then. We'll talk about that after it airs, but go ahead and set this up for me, if you would.
Yeah, so I actually got a phone call from Ed Chiles because I was calling around asking for people who were close to Gwendolyn Brown. She was the first African-American commissioner for Manatee County, and she actually died at 68 years old from complications of coronavirus. And so I was speaking with Ed, who remembered her. And then through that conversation, you know, as part of what's going on with all of my reporting, the question is, so how is coronavirus affecting you? That's what kind of makes coronavirus a unique thing, is that it's affecting every single person in one way or another. So no matter what story I'm reporting on, that's a question for who I'm speaking with. And so Ed, having three restaurants, he ended up telling me that two of his restaurants were still open for takeout at the time in April. And he was explaining to me what he was doing in terms of philanthropy during this time, how to not waste any of the extra food that was left over, and how to keep people safe.
Let's go ahead and hear that audio postcard right now.
Our restaurant family is doing okay, but it's a very, very difficult time for the business and for our people. There's no question about that. Two of our restaurants are still open. They have takeout menus to try to continue to serve the community. We're trying to make sure that we do that in a way where we're observing all the protocols and keeping our people safe and the people that we serve safe. That's something that we relook at on a, not a daily basis anymore, but still a weekly basis. We're trying to do things to be proactive. We have an organic farm, 26 acres, where we grow organic produce, herbs, a lot of brassicas, squashes, a lot of pumpkins, sunflowers, a lot of things that we use in our restaurants. We have surplus, and so we're trying to put that to good use. We're doing an organic half bushel produce box from our Gamble Creek farm that's been very popular for people. We're selling 100 of those a week. We're also assisting the Meals on Wheels Plus in Manatee County and donating and delivering boxes to them for the people that they're serving that really have a lot of needs. We were fortunate to join a program by the Garden Club of Longboat Key where they made a $10,000 grant to get those boxes out to people in need. And we matched that and then had some other matches come in, like Papo's Taqueria came in and did a $5,000 match. So we're going to probably provide about 1,000 of those boxes to our community. That's keeping our people at the farm employed and also at Warden's Farm, who is our partners at Campbell Creek Farm. We're helping the soup kitchen at our Daily Bread from Turning Points, delivering bulk produce to them. And we're trying to get information to our folks about all of the things that they can avail themselves to help them, to our team, our staff, for the three restaurants. We're doing a grocery list as well from the two restaurants. They're doing takeout. We've got our bakery still going. So, you know, on a day-to-day basis, and we're just trying to adjust and to be creative where we can and to get through this. But it's a difficult time. There's no question about that. We need to follow the science here, and we don't want to be reactionary in terms of how we adjust to this, because I think it's important that we, you know, we get through it as quickly and as safely as possible. So, and I think the best way to do that is follow the science. We've got great scientists. They're working overtime on this. Hopefully we can get this testing going. The thing that's driving so much of this is fear. And so, you know, if we can get, you know, really a great amount of testing, if we can see where hotspots are, if we can do the tracing that goes along with that, then maybe that can allow us to try to remove some of this fear and start opening back up prior to a vaccine. But I think in the long run, that's going to be where we need to get. And unfortunately, that's a long way out.
Jessica, this aired about a month ago, and obviously the restaurants have opened up little by little, 25% then 50%. Have you had a chance to talk to Ed Childs since then and see how he's doing?
Yes, actually, he says all three restaurants are open for outdoor seating, and he basically told me that since opening two Mondays ago, he's impressed with the level of business that he's had. So I take it that means, you know, a lot of people are coming in and have been waiting for his food to open up.
Jessica Mazaros, our Morning Edition host and reporter, thank you for bringing these stories of real people to our listeners. We appreciate it.
And thank you, Steve.
And that's it for today's show. You can read more of our audio postcards on our website at wusfnews.org. I'm Steve Newborn. Thanks for listening.